Hello.
Oh, hold on. Speaker. Oh. Okay. How about now?
I can hear you great. You sound fantastic.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I
Hello.
can think you can hear me.
Yes. Yes, I can.
I can't hear you.
Yep. I can hear you.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yep.
Oh,
I
I
can.
can't hear you though. Hold on. Oh,
No.
maybe the volume's not turned up. No,
Maybe
that's not it.
You don't have headphones on.
Hold on. Speaker, microphone. Oh, speaker needs to be those little guys. All right.
Now, little guys. Gotcha. You got me now.
Wait, your default. No, that's not good. No, it's not the right speaker. Speaker, microphone needs to be the microphone, and the speaker needs to be the
speaker.
little guys.
Little guys.
They are.
How little about guys. Now? There
yeah,
we go.
Well, but then your microphone changed.
Oh, fucking A. Oh, this is sorry. 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 Fix that in post.
Yeah.
Bleep. Microphone.
There we go. Microphone.
Yeah. Microphone.
Now. Headphones.
Headphones.
Microphone.
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 We did it. We did it. All right.
God.
We're here. It's almost Pride Month.
It's almost Pride Month.
We made it.
We have successfully logged on to Zoom and we can talk to each other. Wow.
Yeah.
Every time, Ben, it just works.
So, there are a few other podcasts that I listen to where they also have the same problems. So it makes me feel somewhat good about things.
Yeah, like we're functioning at the technological level of John Roderick.
Professionals, people that get paid to do this.
Yeah.
Let me make sure. Oh no, I don't want to run, Don. I don't want to run a backup in my crash plan, right? Do you have crash plan? You know what that
hey,
is?
If you're planning to crash, you're crashing to plan. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah.
No, I use Backblaze and it's great.
Plan twice, crash once. I think it's the same.
Yes,
it's the same
that's
thing.
What they
say. so this, you know, I'm at my home office.
Yes.
And I have a computer here that that is the university manages. And
that's mm-hmm. where you got the trouble.
Yeah, I know.
You get your university managing your computer at your home, and they're not at your home, Ben. They're at the university, so yeah. It's going to necessarily be problematic, as they say.
I have because it's not logging into the NC State network. I have to remember a password from 12 iterations ago of passwords. To get onto this computer.
You know, Ben, I have a crash plan for that too. It's called 1Password, Ben.
Well, but so I also have 1Password. It doesn't work with my login to my computer because I won't fire up 1Password until
because it's not allowed by your university.
Yeah. Until
which is
until
keeping your computer safe mm-hmm. by making use of very old password.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
But it's so, I mean, it's like the Sloan song alludes to. It's so old, it's new again. Yeah. And the Sloan lyric is actually much more eloquent than that. I think it's 15 years ahead of our time or 10 years behind, something like that, which is good, right? Like either 10 years, I don't know. Did you listen to,
you know, I'm trying to Google all of these things and I'm not finding any of them ahead of our time. Right or wrong, 10 years
there
ahead of our time or about 1 year behind.
About 1 year
sometimes
behind
it tends to get to me. Yeah.
I think that's pretty good, right? Like that pretty much describes me. 10 years ahead of our time or about 1 year behind. I can't remember. I don't know which one it is.
Well, I mean, and just to completely close the Canadian rock loop, on the most recent episode of Roderick on the Line, you know what the cover art is, or do you know what the cover art is?
I don't know what the cover art is, but I know they talked a lot about a lot of Canadian bands. There was Sloan, there was The Hip, there's Sarah McLachlan, there's Leslie Feist, the Weaker Thans. It was all so
you,
many.
You've missed the important canonical one.
Oh no, Rush.
Hey,
I knew it.
You like John Roderick, apparently not a fan.
Not at all. Not at all. I can't. And there they are. There I see them. Geddy Lee.
Geddy Lee. Why does he sing so high?
I've been listening to we haven't talked in a while. And the last time we talked, you and I didn't get a chance to talk because we had a guest person on.
It's true.
So I went to see did I tell you that I went to see the Cowboy Junkies? Are you familiar
with
them?
No, I am familiar with them. Cool.
Yeah. It was cool. So here comes some links to show notes. I saw them at the Ha River Ballroom, which is probably the coolest place. You just wait. So you click on this link and it gives you a picture of exactly what it looks like in there. It is an old warehouse or factory that's been turned into a venue. It's so cool. It's almost like a high school gym. Like that's the size of it, but they have this like phenomenal disco ball. And anyway, so I saw the Cowboy Junkies. Sam and I went and saw them there, and he'll go to any concert. So I think I mentioned that, but he was like not super enamored with the Cowboy Junkies because I thought they were phenomenal, but they're just a little bit slow and
a little slow for him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so anyway, they're great. So you're familiar with the Cowboy Junkies. Are you familiar with the Trinity Sessions? Does that make a ring a bell? Am I going too deep here?
You're going too deep. I am only superficially familiar with the Cowboy Junkies. I know I like a couple of their songs. I don't know if I own any of their music.
Okay, well, the Trinity Session came out in 1988, and it was according to the internet information website, Wikipedia, the music was recorded inside Toronto's Church of the Holy Trinity, with the band circled around a single microphone. The album includes a mixture of original material and covers of classic rock, including Sweet Jane, Lou Reed song.
Lou Reed song, yeah.
Yeah, and so I've known about the Cowboy Junkies my entire musical listening life. Like, you know, when this came out, it was 10, you know, I was 10 years old, and it was huge. Like, I don't know what I'm looking here. It ranked chart performance. I guess it was only it peaked at 28 on the Canadian RPM top albums. I don't know if that's good or not, but it was also 26 on the US Billboard 200. But Sweet Jane was like, it was all over the place. And I know every one of these songs. So anyway, they played a bunch of these, including Sweet Jane. And I told Sam, I was like, okay, look, I know you're not like, I'm good. It was a Sunday night. He had school. I'm like, we don't have to stay to the end. So when they play, as long as we get to Sweet Jane, I'm ready to go. And so we listened to, you know, 20, maybe not 20, 18 songs. And then we left, and it was great. They're just phenomenal. Anyway, I don't know why I was telling you that, but I want to do that.
Cause we got talking about music.
And, So we have, I'd like to make an announcement.
You're leaving the show.
I'm not leaving the show. Technically we're both going to leave the show, and my announcement is about that, but about this show, I have a heart out at 4. So,
okay. So you are leaving the show.
I'm leaving the show at 4 p.m. today. So I could have texted you that. But I thought, you know, what's in the show is in the show. And also, you don't talk about the show on the show, but I just,
talk about the show on the show, but yeah, no, at 4 o'clock hard out is fine. I got a meeting with lawyers about a food safety lawsuit about a lawsuit. And so that'll give me an hour to dip my head back into the mess that is that lawsuit.
Perfect.
That's totally fine. Actually, before this call, as I texted to you, I was doing two things. I was pretending to be a member of the news media and listening to our federal agencies update us on the H5N1 outbreak in dairy cattle, and also double dipping because I was working on response to review for a manuscript. That was fun.
We get our press passes, right? Yeah. For all that we get invited to these things now. That was on my list. I made some notes because, you know, this one's my show, so I think about, here's some things that I'd like to talk about. Yours is the other show. So here, in no particular order, things that I want to talk to you about. Grease, not the substance that might build up after on joints things, but the country of Greece. I would like to talk to you about,
I think you're thinking of spliffs.
Definitely thinking of spliffs. and then I want to talk to you about Daily Harvest and Terra Flower. And then I also want to talk to you about the influenza, not the Spanish influenza, but avian influenza, and stuff that we're learning about things, and a really cool, interesting paper that we heard about on our last media availability from our federal agencies about milk pasteurization and stuff like that. I don't think we talked about this, but also I want to talk about I don't know if you know this, but someone that we know, maybe, and I don't want to out them, but might have cooked a whole bunch of I think ground beef with other influenza viruses in it, and tried to understand whether it might survive the cooking process, like a hamburger. So I kind of want to talk about that too.
Yeah,
and then we got follow up, right? Yes. And I only know that because you said, "Hey, there's a bunch of follow up." So
right, and yeah, because my job on this show my job on both the shows is honestly to do a lot of work preparing content, and then you pick what we're going to do. But people do email me, and they email both of us, Ben, responds more than the other, generally speaking. And so we had a bunch of really nice follow-up from our really nice listeners, and I put it all dutifully in the spot where it belongs. And again, sometimes we have that other show where we don't have, where people send us follow-up, but we don't do follow-up on that show. So we've got to do follow-up on this show. It's very confusing, Ben. So there is some items tagged as follow-up in our Dropbox, which we can get to whenever you'd like, because it's your show.
It's my show. So we're going to get to that. And I'm getting those all ready now. There's some other stuff. Hang on. I've been marking things. Well, so let's come back to our friend, John Roderick. do you follow him on the Instagram?
I do. Instagram is not, I need to get better at Instagram, man. I'm not very good at Instagram. And because what happens is my workflow is, I have certain people that I get notifications from if they post on Twitter, and I'll go and look at what they're posting. And then I look at TikTok every day when I'm having my breakfast and my lunch. I watch TikToks. And then periodically I will click on my social media thing on my phone, and it'll show me a bunch of different. Oh, and then the other thing that I regularly do is I use an app called Fetica where I post. So my social media is mostly about posting. It's not about reading. And then I look at my social media thing on my phone and I see inevitably, I see Instagram sitting there and it usually has a number on it. And sometimes that number is one and sometimes it's a really big number and I can't, and it seems to either be one or a really big number. And so when I see that occasionally, oh, I should go see what's on Instagram. Let's do some real time follow up here. I have a red number one on my Instagram. I'm going to hit that. Okay. And yeah. Now Instagram is loading. And I see on Instagram, a video from Celeste Barber.
Oh, yeah, I follow her.
You know Celeste Barber? She's this is a lady, scantily clad who's licking milk off a table, who's a model. And then after a few minutes of that, we go to Celeste recreating that as what it would look like if a normal person did it. And it always makes me laugh.
I know she's very funny. And I think that's a niche of the internet that I didn't even know I needed to have. And then now that she's done it, it's so great. I think that Instagram would be my social media place of choice of drug now, drug of choice. I'm pretty much off of Facebook, maybe once every 3 weeks. I just like scroll through and see if the people who used to be Republican are still Republican
and are they?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think they're they've leveled up, as the gamers would say. And then I also, I still spend some time on Twitter, but less and less. I'm not really on the other ones as much.
On Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon.
No, I haven't gotten any of those. Good. I'm just good with the Instagram now. I like it. And I know it's really Facebook light, right? Like it's all owned by the same, you know, they're all getting my stuff.
Yeah.
But I just like I like the pretty pictures.
Yeah, no, and you posted a really nice, I do like Instagram. I mean, for that reason. And if I could work it into my workflow, I think I would spend more time there. I think I discovered why I got one notification, and that was because we got a Instagram DM, whatever that is, from our good friend Squirrel Chomp Bear Meat, which we recorded, and I was just responding because you were on that and got it into the queue for the other show, but I did not acknowledge it, and so I responded to her just now and indicated when the episode would post. So
excellent.
So everybody can look for that. So
well, that's awesome. So I just sent you on your phone because it's really hard for me to do this.
Yep.
It's not really hard. I didn't send it through the normal spot. But there's an Instagram post that John put up a few days ago that is all about health department inspection ratings. And so I'm gonna read a couple of excerpts of this. And I would like to, I had thought about the, so Don, I do things like, In my preparation for this show, I think about doing things and I just don't do them. So I thought about sending John a message.
Almost the same thing though, right? Thinking about it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now I'm going to tell you what I thought I would do and I haven't done. I almost sent John a message to be like, hey, can you jump on Food Safety Talk and talk to us about health department inspection reports? Maybe I'll do that later and see if he can join us on another one. But he writes, this may be a controversial post. I was in Fremont yesterday and I stumbled into a very, very lovely plant store called At Peace Love and Happiness Club, where I found some nice plants to take home. Walking down the street with my new plants, I decided to take them to lunch. But lo, my favorite Fremont restaurant was only rated okay by the health department. And Don, what does okay mean? Well, Seattle King County, a place that you and I have visited together, which I love this, has now gone to emojis for their restaurant ratings. So they have the worst one is needs to improve, and that's just like a flat mouth, you know, face. Then there's okay, which is like kind of a smirk a little bit, not like a side smirk, but just like a little, you know, a smile. Then there's good, which is a really big smile, and then there's excellent, which is, you know, eyes closed and a big mouth smile. And so wow. John Wright,
Can you send me a link to that?
Yeah. It's in the Instagram post.
Oh, it's in John's Instagram post?
Yeah. If you scroll to the side, you'll
see. Oh, okay. This is why I'm not good at Instagram, because I now see that there's a little side arrow. I was looking at, so the name of the plant store is called Peace, Love, and Happiness, right?
Yes.
And you can see, speaking of icons, peace, love, plus smiley happiness. Face.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. That's the emoji. That's the restaurant emoji. You can see why I was confused.
Yeah.
There's
just
too many emojis and I'm old.
And I thought it was that too. Yeah.
Wow. And so I love that.
It's an okay. So he says the emoji based signage is fairly new, but it's very effective in communicating some basic truths.
Yeah.
Some places have excellent. And you see that, you think right on. Even when seeing a good rating gives you a second of pause. What's the deal with just good? But an okay rating, it's pretty shocking.
It's a good thing it's not any worse, because then it would be needs to improve, which is just a flat, not even a smile.
Yeah. So anyway, a lot. So then
John's sitting there eating lunch with his plants.
With his plants.
Great. I love it.
Yeah. So I took my plants and had a great meal. The plants had water. The lady wasn't there. The man cooked the food, and it was the same as it's been for 20 years. While I was there, six more people came in. I looked it up, and they have had no violations the last four inspections, so they need a new sign. It should read excellent. But he said, okay, I wanted to take my plants to lunch and reflect on how everything is mediated now, rated and mapped. It doesn't take much to start following ratings and maps and stars to the exclusion of our senses. I don't mean to compare the health department with Yelp. I have the utmost respect for the health department, as much as I hate Yelp. I just mean that for everything you do is a calculated risk. I've eaten in plenty of top scoring places that suck. Ratings tell you some things, not all, which is exactly true. Like this is the thing that I kind of love about some of our friends from the internet, is that they are, you know, we're in the in group, right? Like in the food safety in group. But if you're on the outside, just because something has a good rating or an okay rating doesn't reflect exactly what's happening at that time. And so to John's point, you know, over time, something's happened and maybe they need a new sign or reinspection or whatever. But I always love to hear someone else's perspective, who's not you and I, that are thinking about this all the time. And his perspective on health department stuff.
Yeah. Well, and for obvious reasons, John has not named the restaurant, although obviously if you are familiar with that location, you could figure it out, because it's in an old house a few blocks from a canal, and behind it across the alley is an aerospace metal plating company that's a proper industrial environment, right? So if you know that place, you know the restaurant. I would really be interested in looking at the ratings for this restaurant, so that we could give our maybe perhaps somewhat more informed opinion. I mean, obviously, John has been informed. He's chosen to eat here anyway. He eats here all the time. He would go no matter what the rating said, as long as the restaurant wasn't closed down. But I would be interested. And what it was, and again, this is such a great reason, like, because we know John, he's been a guest on, we know not as much as you can know somebody you've never met except on a podcast, but listen to every word that they've said on another podcast since it started 10 years ago. But what did he say? It's probably that they leave stuff out and they're lackadaisical, right? And that doesn't concern John. And knowing John, that does not, or knowing, I'm using Richard Fingers, knowing John, that doesn't surprise me. That seems like John would be like, yeah, it's fine. There's big portions, and the lady meets you at the door and she kind of yells at you.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the thing that I've really I love about the perspective of what you and I try to do, which is not to tell people don't eat at this restaurant, but it's that things that you do are a calculated risk, right? And get the information. And if you're cool with the risk, take the risk whatever. So anyway, I thought it was cool. I was scrolling through that somewhere. I don't know. I've been all over the world recently. So it came up and I was like, oh, we should talk to John. So, and we had, like I said, we had him on. Let's invite him again.
Absolutely.
He wants to tell us about emoji, but I love the emojis too. This is not the first time I've seen the emoji. I think the emojis came out of New Zealand, like a long time ago.
Oh, those for public health, you mean?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I remember. Here we go. I don't know what this is. I'm just like Googling things, and this says a challenge to public health sector. The Mosul emoji will give. It's time to get your emojis on. This is probably not the right thing. I'll see if I can find it. So anyway, I thought that was cool. I do want to tell you about Greece. So let's do
yes.
That. I think in one of the previous episodes we alluded to this, but I went on a study abroad trip for 2 weeks to Greece, and it was the name of the program was very clever. It was C Greek agriculture, like as in SEE, not SEA, mm-hmm. and C stands for science, education, and extension inside Greek agriculture. Cool. Yeah, and so here we go. We'll take a there's a post on this anyway. So it was. Have you been to Greece before? Have you been there?
Yes,
for
any, I have been. Yeah. I have been to Athens at least once because the predictive modeling meeting was there at one point. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I was only really in Athens for about 20 hours and it was mm-hmm. beautiful and awesome. I spent most of the time, or we spent most of our time in a city north of Athens by about 4 hours called Thessaloniki. So let me find the spot left for you. And it is, it's in Macedonia. Or Macedonia, as I think maybe they might say. I don't know how it's pronounced.
Okay.
But it was kind of in the I mean, all right, I'm gonna totally like botch all of this, but do you know like all the history of Greece? Like how there were the Greek people there, and then they were conquered by the Romans, and then it was the Byzantine Empire occupied them for a long time, right. And then the Ottoman Empire came in.
I know they have a lot of beef with the Turks, and they disagree on who invented baklava and a bunch of other stuff. So yeah, I am not I mostly as a kid I was super into Greek and Roman mythology, and again I would love a chance to go to Greece and to get out of Athens and to see really the countryside and the all of the islands. And yeah, there's like I would love to have done the kind of trip that you did. It sounds amazing.
It was really, really cool. It was you can see if you go to the Wikipedia page I just said on Thessaloniki, you can see the really cool they're on the right side, the demographics of Thessaloniki between 1500 and 1950, which blows my mind a little bit, but it was Greeks, Turks, and Jews, and then the
lions
the,
and tigers and bears.
Yeah. And then there's this drop in basically 1920 was when the occupation was over, somewhere around then, 20 or 21. And so then it's all been Greeks since then. It's all Greek to me since then. So there's like a ton of like wild history of like you go into a church, and I'm not like, hey, let's go look at a bunch of churches, but we did. But I thought it was kind of cool because all the churches were churches. Then they were like Orthodox churches, and then they were like Byzantine churches built then, and then the Ottomans came in and made them all mosques, and then they became churches again, which I think that's a really interesting part of the history. And then the other kind of joke about Thessaloniki, and I guess we don't have the same kind of history perspective here in North America. But they've been trying to build a metro system in Thessaloniki for like 30 years. But every time they pick a place to go build a metro station, they uncover some archaeological site. And so they can't build a metro station there. And it was really like, it was interesting to see like active archaeology sites right in the middle of this city as well. So anyway, it was beautiful. We were in Thessaloniki for about a week at the American Farm School. And it's like not right down like downtown or in the center of the city, but it's outside, and I'll send you a link to that. And so this place was really, really cool. So the history of it was, it was built after 30 years of service in the Balkans, enlightened American educator Dr. John Henry House, with his wife Susan Adeline, founded the American Farm School in 1904 in the outskirts of Thessaloniki. The first students were boys orphaned in one of the many uprisings marking the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. And so there was a whole bunch of this whole school was built to sort of like train orphans for the agriculture workforce. And it's all about like taking American agricultural ideas and philosophy and applying them in Greece and in the Balkans. And so it was like, it was really, really cool. And so we spent the first week, you know, listening to lectures from the professors who are residents there. Everything that they teach there is in English, but they're, you know, Greek professors talking about the Mediterranean diet, and had a really, really interesting lecture on Greek and EU food labeling laws. Like, I mean, nerded out, Don. Like, oh, this, wow. Yeah. And it was really cool just to like, you know, comparing. The professor did a phenomenal, I can't remember his name, but he did a phenomenal job just showing what, you know, what our labeling looks like and what their labeling looks like, and the reasons why it's created that way. And so it was really cool. Then we went and saw, like, went to an olive orchard and had, you know, multiple traditional Greek tavern dinners, which is a lot of seafood. Talked about animal welfare in Greece, food labeling and composition. I already mentioned that. We did a walking food tour of a traditional Greek market. It tasted a whole bunch of stuff. Did a cooking lesson, a traditional Greek cooking. Went and saw a lavender distillery with lavender going into soaps, but also used as an essential oil and ingredient in foods. Olive oil and just a lot of, it was really, really cool. And this is my first study abroad experience. And have you ever gone on study abroad, like at Rutgers at all?
I have not. No, I have not done that.
It was, I can't speak highly enough about the support and infrastructure that NC State has for these types of trips. And also the planning that Joseph Donaldson, who's a faculty member in my department, he led this whole thing. I just kind of was along for the ride. The work that he put in, and then our hosts at the American Farm School, it's called Paradis College, and that they like, I mean, you know, you travel internationally like I do. This was like every time we got somewhere, the hotel already had our keys laid out, just like here's your keys, right? Like there's no checking in, there's no, you know, 24 people waiting in a lobby, like, okay, let's go through all of this. Everything was taken care of, and you know, the money was prepaid and wired for everything to make it really like seamless. And it was like that, all the hard parts of international travel were gone for this, which was really, really
right,
cool.
Right. Nice.
So yeah, it was great. And you know, and I won't like, you know, opsec a bunch of folks, but we had 20 students. A handful of those students were graduate students, the majority were undergraduates, and many of the students had never like been out of North Carolina, and certainly many of them had never been out of the United States before. And so that it was a really I can't speak enough about the experience. Like just And being around students for the first time, like, you know, experiencing something like this as well. So I would, this is my plug for listeners of the show of like, if you're a student and you're thinking about doing study abroad, go do it. And if you're not a student and you're in higher education, you're thinking about like being part of a study abroad experience, go do it. It was awesome. It was really, really good.
Cool.
One thing I do, I'm going to send you a picture here. I'll send you a couple pictures. One tavern I went to, I want to talk about this. This is, we could do this in Risky or Not, but I want to talk about it with you here now today in our Grease segment. Let me find it here. I took way too many pictures. There are a number of pictures coming your way here. You get that one. You get this one. Sorry, I know the listeners love this.
Yep.
Okay. Have you had a chance to look at your phone yet?
No, but I will do that right now.
There are a few more coming here. What can you describe to the listeners what you see here? What just set the stage of what
cats.
You uh-huh. Yep.
Cats in a restaurant.
Yep. A number of cats.
Yeah, quite a few cats.
So the
first I would say they probably don't have a mouse problem, or maybe they did.
this is an indoor restaurant.
Okay.
The first picture that I sent you has three cats. The second picture I sent you has a fourth different cat. And then I sent you three more photos.
I'm allergic to cats and I just sneezed, Ben.
Yep. So what are we up to? That was four.
Well, yep.
There's a fifth cat. This one cat is on a table.
Yep. Oh and yeah. I can see these cats are well fed.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And then my favorite one is the last one that I sent you, which is a little bit, you're going to have to zoom in on it on your phone, but this is my table.
Oh, this is that with the cat sniffing.
Yeah. The cat is sitting in a chair. Like it's eating dinner with me.
Yeah. Yeah, just looking for treats.
Yeah, so I didn't look this up. I didn't ask anybody about it, but I know like this would not fly here. No pun intended.
Likely would not.
Right? Like but also you know, like not to do a Risky Around episode here. I'm not too worried about it. I think people probably don't want cat hair in their food, but when you go into this restaurant, you like look around. We're in cat like that is it is six different cats that I saw. They love cats there.
Clearly,
yeah. So that was probably the only real food safety thing that I saw the whole time. That I was there. Like there was
oh interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like food, like not food safety, but something that I could bring back and be like, hey, Lou, should talk about this. There like everything we toured a plant, and actually I'll see if I can look this up, send you a link to it. We toured a feta cheese plant that was probably the best food manufacturing plant tour I've ever been on. It was like almost
oh really.
Two and a half hours long. We saw everything. You know, on this show, we've talked about robots mm-hmm. but doing things. This place had a lot of robots making cheese. There were a lot of people too as well. So here, I'll probably not be able to pronounce this correctly, but is Epiros cheeses. Cool. And yeah. And so I was just so impressed, like walking around. It was clean. You could tell. And so I've since learned as I walked into this place is not exactly what I thought I was going to see, but I was like sneakily thinking, I bet you they sell to the US and to like some big retailers. And they do. Mm-hmm. And then you could like, as I walked through, you could see their GFSI audit information and all of the like SQF it was the cleanest food plant that I've ever been to. Hmm. So that was really cool too. And so it was really interesting to walk through with students in these situations, and they're asking questions about food safety. And some of them have had either mostly undergrads have had been exposed to, you know, maybe a food micro class or an animal science class where they're talking about microbiology. And so we went, one of the first things we did in this, and in this dairy was we went to their quality assurance lab. And so they said, okay, so every lot, we're taking a number of samples. We age it. So we're now sampling. So they have a sample and hold process because the process is hold, right? Like they're going to age the cheese for 2 months. So they take a bunch of samples and they do an enrichment, and they're looking for listeria, and they're looking for salmonella, and they're looking for, trying to think what else did they say? It was a surprising one. It wasn't Campylobacter, and it wasn't staph, or it might've been staph aureus or something. So it was the third thing.
Yeah.
But not like E. coli or pathogenic E. coli, but they did say that they also sample all of their incoming raw milk that's coming from the farmers that they contract with. So they're looking for, in that case, salmonella, and then they're doing the pasteurization on site.
Right.
I had this whole conversation with one of the students who was like, oh my gosh, I don't think I want to eat anything from here. And I was like, why is that? And so she's like, well, you know, they're only sampling for salmonella. And they said they sample for salmonella before and after pasteurization. So raw milk coming in, looking for salmonella, pasteurized milk that they've pasteurized, they're taking a sample of that every day and looking for salmonella. And she's like, well, why aren't they looking for E. coli 157H7? Why aren't they looking for listeria? Why aren't they looking for, Campylobacter or all these other things? And so it was really cool to talk through, you know, like, okay, well, in raw milk, they're really not all that concerned because they know they're going to pasteurize it. And, you know, talking about the hardiest of the pathogens that might be of concern for them, that salmonella is the hardiest. So if salmonella survives, we got a problem. But if we didn't look for salmonella, now we got to look for everything else. And so just like having a student see this, learn it in real time, and have the aha moment was like really, really cool, which I've never experienced that before. So
yeah. Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. So anyway, I would certainly suggest if you have a chance, this would be great for anybody out there to go be part of this. So that was my Greece experience. Let's talk. So you want to talk about Daily Harvest and Terra Flower?
Yeah.
So you talked to, let's just say a journalist, I think, right? Because I got a message saying, hey, I got your name from your good friend Don Schaffner.
Yeah, I would say I think we can safely say that I talked to somebody from Bloomberg, and the story is going to come out on Monday. So I think we're fine to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we can. And so do you want, this episode's not going to come out until the article's out. So okay. That part I know.
Right.
So did you, I missed this while I was away. I missed it too.
I'm a little embarrassed that the reporter clued me into this, do you talk to him?
Yeah. I talked to him for like half an hour today.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Yeah. Cause I just found him to be like, he was just like super engaging, and he asked good questions, and we just had a really nice chat. So what Ben and I are talking about is a constituent update from FDA. And the update is entitled FDA update on the post-market assessment of Terra Flower. And then the first sentence of that update says today, that's May 15th, U.S. Food and Drug Administration posted on its website its determination that Tara flour, T-A-R-A flour, in human food does not meet the generally recognized as safe or GRAS standard and is an unapproved food additive. And GRAS in that particular message is, I believe, not a link to the general definition of GRAS, but is in fact a link to, oh no, it is. All right. Well, where is this? Somewhere in here, there is a, let's see. Oh, a memo. Right. So the second link is to a memo, which is added to the agency's public inventory. And that memo is where the action really is. So this is a memorandum dated April 10th, 2024 by blank PhD, a toxicologist. and all of the people's information who wrote, the person who wrote this, the person that they sent it through, the person that they sent it to, although you could probably figure out who the acting director of OFAS CIFSAN is, would be is all redacted. And that's fine. That's just how FDA do. And so, yeah. And it's an absolutely fascinating memo, which I read in detail before talking with this reporter. And so it basically FDA lays out in all of its excruciating FDA detail, like, what does it mean for something to be GRAS? And what are the criteria for something to be GRAS? And what do we know about Terra Flower? And what's the regulatory status of Terra Flower? And how was it used prior to 1958? And scientific evidence based on scientific procedures, the technical evidence of safety, and they searched the literature. And then they talked about the more recent literature and this lack of sufficient data to establish safety for food use, and on and on and on, basically leading to their conclusion at the end of this very long memo, which is still loading on my computer, basically saying, let's see, due to the lack of adequate data and information in the scientific literature to support the safe use of Terra Flower in food, DFI is unable to conclude that the addition of Terra Flower to food meets the statutory criteria for classification as GRAS. Boom.
Yeah.
You're done. Don't use this in food. It is not GRAS.
I think this is interesting. This is the first time that I can think about this happening. Well, and again, right.
And that was a question that the reporter has. Have you ever heard of this happening? And I'm like, I don't think so. We have had examples of people using stuff in food that they shouldn't. I mean, you know, top of mind for me is cinnamon containing lead acetate. I think it was lead acetate in applesauce. And then also melamine in dairy products, right? Like, so we have examples of people using stuff they shouldn't, which is economic adulteration. This was not economic adulteration. This was just incompetence or using something in food that was not that should not be in food, basically, bottom line. Really interesting deep dive from the agency that took their time, but I think they eventually got to where they needed to get to. And again, they still haven't. And one of the other things too, that was fascinating to me in this memo was they really stay very, very clear of the current situation going on with Daily Harvest. They're like, this is not about Daily Harvest. This is not about that. This is about something else, which is related, which is Terra Flower a GRAS? And the answer is no, but we're not talking about Daily Harvest. We're talking about Terra Flower. And so really just really interesting again. And I've, you know, written by a toxicologist, a scientist, but boy, I bet the lawyers were back and forth and up and down all over this thing to make sure that FDA did not compromise its position on anything other than simply talking about the exact thing that they wanted to talk about here.
Right. Well, and this, I thought that this was really like key to the conversation that I had with the journalist where, you know, he asked a really good question just about like, you know, who should be responsible for this, right? Like who should, and so I'm like, look, GRAS is one thing, right? And the fact that a company thinks that this might be GRAS or submits it to FDA to be GRAS, but what they did feel like, again, I don't want to get too far in the legal side of things because I'm out over my skis on that, but it feels like Daily Harvest operated for quite some time and selling products that had Terra Flower in it, and that wasn't like quote unquote illegal, right? Like it was on the market. They're not, but it was like I don't feel like they were breaking any sort of regulatory rule during that, but maybe they were, and I'm just not, like, I don't see it. But to me, where I kind of steered the conversation was, like, it doesn't really matter whether it was, like, grass or legal or not. I mean, it does a little bit, but this is a new novel protein. Someone needs to figure out whether it's got toxicity in the form that people are going to consume it in. And that is like, that really matters. That, like, to me, the responsibility comes down to, like, both the ingredient supplier that sold them the stuff and Daily Harvest, right? It's not Daily Harvest. I don't think can, like, say that. Well, I mean, they can say all they want, but I wouldn't agree with them saying, well, this person sold me an ingredient that said it was for food, and we just trusted them, put it in our food, and turns out it gave people a whole bunch of really bad, like, you know, liver issues, and that's not our fault because we bought it from someone. It's like, if you're formulating a new product, you got to do your due diligence. Like, you're both, to me, you're both at fault on this one.
Yeah. Well, and let's come back to that. But yeah, and it sounds like we had a very similar conversation. And so what I will say is, maybe what they did on the face of it is not illegal, but you know what it is illegal to do is to give people food that hurts them, right? That is definitely illegal, right?
Yeah.
Whether the technical, whether it was technically legal or not is a separate question. And again, and the question from the reporter, he was saying, like, what's the supplier's responsibility? I'm like, well, their supplier has some responsibility. And believe me, when this stuff goes down, everybody's suing everybody, right? But here's the thing. Daily Harvest has a responsibility to make sure that the ingredients that it includes in its food are safe, right? Basically, bottom line. So yes, I mean, there may be some burden placed on the ingredient supplier, but there's also a burden on Daily Harvest. There, you're not just allowed to go out and buy whatever you want from whoever you want and use it to make whatever you want, right? Like, that's not allowed, because you can't make people sick. You can't, and they very much did. So yeah.
And the thing, like, the other thing that I mentioned, maybe you and I are one of, you know, we share one mind in some of these conversations, because you might have said the same thing. But I was like, look, you know, I can name you probably, like, you know, 50 international, multinational food companies that don't do stuff like this, that I bet off the record. If you talk to, and I'll throw names out there, and I don't know if this is true or not, but if you went to, like, Nestle or Mondelez or General Mills, you know, whomever, right, that they have a whole process for, hey, we're changing an ingredient, we're changing maybe even a supplier, somebody here needs to do a risk assessment. And different from, like, risk assessment that you and I talk about, like a microbial risk assessment, but, like, what's our business risk on this? And Okay, do we need to know more about toxicity? What quantity are we going to put this in? And I bet you that almost every one of those companies that I mentioned, and probably 50 others, have gone down a product development path and said, yeah, we're not doing that. Like, we're not putting X in there because we don't know. Like, and I just I know, because I've had those conversations with a number of people, but that's not going to show up anywhere, right? Because the things that people don't put in food doesn't, like, we don't know about it.
Right. Exactly.
So anyway, I thought it was a great conversation, but it did, like, I did say to the journalist, you know, this is unique, and I don't, it's like, I'm not going to throw FDA under the bus on this one at all. Right. Like the rules that we have are based on the information we have at the time. Right. And a snapshot in time. And so we don't, you know, we didn't get too far into this, but, like, the question was kind of like, well, should FDA have done something about this before? Should they be doing a better job of monitoring what companies like Daily Harvest are doing? And it's like, I don't think so. I think, you know, the speed that which the regulatory world can act on stuff, like, we just saw it here, it's 2 years, right, from the outbreak to get this.
And FDA does not have, I mean, FDA has very limited resources, and they inspect people like Daily Harvest if they know about them, they inspect them once a year, right? And probably that's only for operations that they think are higher risk. And this operation is probably, you know, I mean, they're much more worried about low acid canned food operations or other operations that would, on the face of it, be potentially more risky. I don't know how often Daily Harvest gets inspected, right? And even if you were inspecting them, what would you have found except that they're using an ingredient which seems on the face of it to be a normal ingredient, right?
Yep. Yeah. Right. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And that know? Is, yeah. Like, I think that was the, that's the whole, like, I don't think, I think this one to me solely lies within, you know, the world of someone who's doing research and development and developing a new product and also their suppliers, like FDA. Yeah. So I agree. And I think, you know, one of the other things I shared, and I don't know, you know, I felt it was like really, I was sitting outside at a Starbucks while I was talking to the journalist and drinking an iced latte. You know, I'm fully refreshed after my international trip. So I was on fire today, Don. And so, you know, I said a few things, which hopefully, like, you know, if it ends up in the article, it's great. But it probably won't, like, you know, basically that there's a lot, like, there are a lot of companies out there that are small startups that have a really novel, good idea, but are light on science and risk. Right. Yep. And so that's there's lots and lots of them. You don't see the big established, you know, sometimes they're talked about in the, you know, in the media or just in public, you know, discussion about sort of evil, faceless multinationals. Well, they're not doing stuff like this for the most part, right? Like they take a process of low risk to their brand. And so, this was like, I think that they're, you know, the journalist asked about, like, well, what, you know, is this a big trend of like new novel ingredients? And I was like, yeah, every year at the IFT trade show, you can walk around and see, you know, hundreds of different, you know, flavor, colors and, you know, different food combinations and different ingredients that are a response to what the public, you know, issue of the day is, whether it's like higher protein or more fiber or like lower, saturated fats or whatever. And everyone's trying to look for different ingredients that can meet the goals I don't want to paint a picture that all startups are bad, because they're not, but often the ones that are trying to get things moving with very limited budget and don't have someone on staff that can do toxicity work, or know the right consultant to do, to call, or the right academic to do it, they can get themselves in trouble. And that's, you know, kind of what I saw today, you know, what I saw with this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And a big multinational would never do something like this. It would take, because they just wouldn't pass muster. Right.
Yeah.
What do you mean you're using this ingredient that we've never heard of before? No, we're not going to do that.
Right. We're not. Yeah, exactly.
At least I think so. I mean, if somebody that works for one of those big companies, you know, reach out to us on the down low and let us know if you guys dodged a bullet with TerraFlower. But I've got to imagine that the way these companies operate, the big companies operate, they have so much to lose that they're very, very risk averse, whereas a small startup just doesn't think that way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. And that I'm getting more like cynical too, that I think that are like people like you and I, and I mean, it's really not even you and I, it's like a bunch of our colleagues who work in the world of process authority, who work in the world of like working directly with startup companies on food solutions or, you know, whatever. I think the number and the time, the number of those individuals is dwindling. Like it's getting smaller and smaller, and the amount of time pressure that's on those individuals is increasing. So there's less, you know, public land grant institution support nationally for people who are who need help like this, right? Like, and, right. and I think that's difficult. Like, I think about it, in the retail world where you and I kind of work as well. There are very few academics that are able to help a business with some of their problems. I don't know. I got a message today, and this one's very specific, but I'll read it to you without OPSEC and the person who's asking. But it was, do you have any good academic contacts in Saskatchewan that could be a subject matter expert on using time as a public health control in restaurants?
Huh.
And it's like, no, that person doesn't exist. Like, I don't, like, I mean, you know, there's probably, you know, I gave this person a couple of names. I was like, you should really, like, there's a couple of people in all of Canada that I think are up to speed in that work, right? That are actively engaged in it. So I was like, you should call Larry Goodrich or Ian Young.
Yep.
I'm like, yeah, those are the two. And they're both in Ontario. But I mean, that's, you know, those are the resources those are the people. And I feel like I don't know. I feel like you and I would know if there was someone there, right? Like just by you know, knowing the landscape of who's doing what out there. So I don't know. My cynicism is that there are less and less of us, and you and I are, and I'm dwindling. There's less and less of me as well.
Yeah.
Not that I'm like the important, you know what I mean? But like there's,
No, but I mean, there's more.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's more and more problems to be solved. Well, and here's the thing, like, this is it. Cause I was talking, today actually, and yesterday with a local public health person about cottage foods, and cottage foods is exploding here in New Jersey. And we don't have the resources at the state level, to really manage that appropriately. And so, and of course what our state people do is they're very risk averse. And what that means is that they push back on things that people are trying to do. And it's just, and, you know, we're trying to get involved and we're trying to help wherever we can, but, you know, there's a limit to what we can do as well. And trying to figure out, okay, like, how am I going to strategically use my resources to do the things that I need to do, and yet still keep all the other things that I'm trying to do, at the same time. Right. And it's a challenge. Yeah. It's a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough one. So, well, and speaking of which, I mean, this goes into the other topic that I wanted to make sure we hit today, which is this, a couple of episodes ago, we talked a little bit about this, but like the consumption of food in the midst of this, H5N1, is that right? Mm-hmm. H1N5. Yep. Yeah. I was like, I just had like a brain contraction there where it was like, is it H1N5? No, it's H5N1. This H5N1 outbreak that we're seeing and experiencing across the US and the food stuffs, and that, you know, I feel like we're past today's embargo, right, Don? We can talk about the new information.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So new information as of today, and again, this will probably evolve because it won't be, it might be a week before I post this. But that that there's a third individual, third human person who's contracted, right, H5N1. Also someone who is associated with the dairy industry. Is that's correct? A dairy employee?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is a third dairy worker. And the unique thing about this person is that apparently I did not realize that there was three. I thought there was only one, but apparently there was a second dairy worker who got conjunctivitis that was linked to the virus. But this third person, they have respiratory symptoms. And that is what is new.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say alarming, but certainly, you know, and the agencies repeatedly, CDC, I think specifically repeatedly made the claim like, well, this is, we haven't changed our threat level, or we haven't changed, you know, our alert level or whatever, but realize that when a virus like this causes respiratory symptoms, it's more easily spread, right?
Yep.
The way
yep.
that you get conjunctivitis from somebody is you jam your finger in their messed up eye, right? The way you get it from a respiratory infection is that they breathe on you. So it's a little bit different there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you got conjunctivitis. I mean, every time someone gets like pink eye, I think of the are you familiar with the 40-year-old virgin movie?
I am.
And that someone got pink eye, and it was related to farting on someone's pillow, got poop on your pillow. So and then you went to this, which is probably not the way that person got conjunctivitis.
No, I think probably not. Yes.
it's probably more like from a dairy, like a cow.
But and another interesting factoid that I heard on the call today is it is now is 66 herds in 9 states that are impacted. The number of herds keeps going up, but the number of states is constant. So we're not seeing it spread to other states. 40 people have been tested for the virus. There's 350 people enrolled in ongoing testing. Or something. I took rather cryptic notes, but I mean, the main thing is with this person that has respiratory symptoms, now we're monitoring secondary contacts of that person, right, to see if it spreads to other people. And everybody's been offered Tamiflu, and people are taking it, right? So they're taking antivirals or anti-flu medicines. They've been testing a load of cattle, right? 17,000 PCR tests of cattle. That doesn't mean 17,000 cattle. It's more than 17,000 cattle because they're pooling the milk from the cattle, and then so that means they're doing that. And again, also one other thing I heard, which was interesting, which is a little bit of a difference from what I'd heard before, is that no cows have actually died from this. Apparently, some cows have died, but they were autopsied. They were put down for purposes of basically doing an autopsy. They didn't actually die from the virus. So cows do seem to make a full recovery, although when they're infected, they're shedding a lot of virus in their milk.
Well, I guess the other, to close the loop on this, is there was a really interesting article that you shared with me that I think came out from, like, I think CDC shared this last week, right?
Yep.
On cow's milk containing H5N1 and heat inactivation, which yep. looks really, really good, but then infectivity in mice in consumption of untreated milk, which, which I guess, last time we had talked, and what I had, this made me reframe things a little bit, right? Like, raw milk's always been risky, and maybe this, like, just having the virus in that raw milk, I said before I read this paper, because this work hadn't been done, that I'm like, it's like theoretically more risky, but I don't think it's measurable. I think that this tells me it's measurably more risky, that if it's in there, consuming raw milk, I guess in this paper, it's specifically to infectivity in mice. Right. And so it is certainly possible to get H5 or mice to get H5N1 by consuming milk that has the virus in it. But the mechanism, which with how they drink milk, may be a factor there as well, similar to what we talked about around cats.
With cats, right. Yep. Exactly. Exactly.
The other good news from this paper was, and I'll just read it, I think it's the last sentence, if I remember correctly, our data indicate that the virus in untreated milk can infect susceptible animals that consume it. In summary, high pathogenic H5 positive milk poses a risk when consumed untreated, but heat inactivation under the laboratory conditions here reduces the virus titers by more than 4.5 log units. And they did a lot of different experiments about, like, heat treatment and different types of PCR settings as well. So I thought this was, like, this is a good, I may have mentioned this already, but it's in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was a letter, but it was like a three-page letter that kind of says, here's a small experiment that needed to be done really quickly. And it was great. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Three-page letter. And the last page is mostly taken up by the author's names and affiliations.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the second page is the table of data.
It's the table of data. Right. But just a little bit on the mouse experiment. They basically orally inoculated mice with 10 to the 6th plaqueforming units of one of the samples. The animals showed signs of illness starting on day one, ruffled fur and lethargy. All of the animals survived until day four when they were euthanized. They detected high virus titers in the respiratory organs, which suggests that infection may have occurred through the larynx, or the, sorry, the pharynx, and moderate virus titers in several other organs, findings consistent with systemic infections typically caused by HPAI-H5 viruses in mammals. Detection of the virus in the mammary glands of two mice was consistent with the high virus load in the milk of lactating cows, even though these mice were not lactating. So there is something apparently about this virus in that it likes or it can live in mammary glands of not just cows, but of mice as well.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. All right, here's our deal. We got 11 minutes. We should.
Oh shoot, time flies. All right.
Yeah, I know. Well, we're having fun, Don, and I talked a lot today. Let's talk. Let's do some follow up.
Sure. Can I do a little bit of real time follow up from elsewhere in this show?
Yes.
So one of the things that I was doing while you were talking, I was of course paying complete attention to your stories about Greece. But I was trying to do a little bit of reconnaissance. You know, as Merlin often says, John, don't give the internet a puzzle. But John gave the internet a puzzle. And so I am looking to see if I can find this restaurant. I could not find it. But what I did find was I put in the same zip code as the plant store and found restaurant inspection results. And so I will put this in the Zoom chat for you to see. But we will also put this in show notes for anybody that wants to do a little bit more reconnaissance on this important mission. Please don't give the internet a puzzle. But basically, that is a listing of inspections with the same zip code as the plant store, nominally sorted by inspection score, although I couldn't figure out a way to really figure it out in any more detail than that. But at least it's, you know, I mean, it's anyway, I feel bad now because I'm violating Merlin's decree.
Never give the internet a. Yeah, there you go. Good job. Awesome. So some quick hitters on other follow-up. Someone sent us a message and I can't remember who it was, but oh no, they found some pink sauce at a salvage at a salvage grocery store, right? I've seen on TikTok and Instagram pink sauce, lots of pictures of pink sauce. And then you remarked it's not that pink.
Yep. It's not that pink.
Not that, and which is, it's not. And that's probably because of the formulation of all the dragon fruit would not have made it possible to, it would make it harder to acidify. Not, it would be possible. Then we got this, this is the one that I wanted to highlight. We got one of our, Deep New England sent us a message.
Mm-hmm.
And so Deep New England writes, "This is so odd that I had to share it with colleagues who would appreciate it. I bought a bag of chips over the weekend in Maine. It was a Pennsylvania-based chip brand we weren't familiar with. When my husband opened them, I was in the other room, and as he exclaimed, 'There's a washcloth in this bag of chips.'"
Yes.
"I thought it must be a new freshness packet or something, but lo and behold..."
Nope, it's a washcloth.
"It was an actual washcloth. He was so disappointed, but I thought, what an excellent example of physical contamination." And this picture is amazing. And so, just so you know, Don, today's show title will be "There's a washcloth in this bag of chips." and the picture of this will be the show notes the picture. But it's like a full washcloth. Like, we're not talking a little slice of a washcloth. This is pretty hilarious.
But I love the follow up again, because our listeners are the best. So Deep New England, I suggest that she should call the customer service hotline, and she says, "Oh, I've been chatting with them. This morning I spoke with the QC manager, Lisa. She let me know that they use thousands of those cloths a week to produce over a million bags of chips in a week." The customer service person I spoke with yesterday let it slip that it happens about twice a year. I don't know if it happens twice a year, that's a reproducible problem. You should be able to engineer that out.
Well, and so I like, what do you do? So I, you know, if you got this, are you recalling your products? Like, you know, you got a whole washcloth, right?
No,
I don't think
there's
so.
Yes, it is a, it's physical contamination. It's not a physical hazard. Someone is not going to accidentally eat this washcloth
right.
because it's huge. You know, it
doesn't
bad.
Look like a chip.
It doesn't look like a chip. It's too big. you could probably figure out how it happens, right? Couldn't you? I'm not an expert in chip manufacturing or washcloths, but it seems to me like you should be able to figure this out and then put something in place to stop it.
It's probably some like summer intern kid who just threw it in there as a joke.
Well, then how does that happen twice a year then?
It's part of the initiation process. You're welcome to the job, kid. Throw this in there.
Yeah.
All right. What else do we have here? Oh, we did have so we did get this cool feedback from a few days ago. I don't know if this ended up with I think this was feedback, right? The mix up of drinking and irrigation water sparks dangerous outbreak in children. We talked about this Risky or Not, didn't we?
Risky or Not. We sure did.
Yeah. And it was like, is it okay for my kid to be in the sprinkler of this? Right. Or something.
And the answer I think was no.
Yeah. 13 children sickened, 7 hospitalizations, 2 with HUS. From this. So risky. And we'll link to the Ars Technica article. But I think like someone asked us this question and then he answered it, and then now there's an outbreak.
Right.
Like, wow. That's gotta be the first time that's happened for us.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't remember this. I'll link to the article. I don't remember the specifics of the article, exactly why we were talking about it, like exactly why we were talking about it. But yeah.
Someone sent us a message about it.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Oh, but because maybe there was an alert that was sent out or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's what it was. If I remember the Risky or Not, it was that there was an alert a couple of weeks afterwards that said this mix up had happened. Yeah, well, that's not good. But this was, remember we learned about like that there was this irrigation water, like public, like water, like I'd never even heard of that before, that you could have irrigation. Yeah.
Yeah. And we linked to an article from the Daily Herald, saying more E. coli cases appeared in Leahy, city taking steps to treat irrigation water. And that was in August, 2023.
Yeah.
So 12 people have got infected.
Yeah.
And again, it's children. So, last summer led to an outbreak. Oh, all right. So this is just the same story. This is the 2023 outbreak. So this is not news necessarily, but it's just the Ars Technica article.
It's more info.
Yeah, more info. But we covered this before Ars Technica. So just so you know.
Well, hey, that's why we're in the esteemed media.
Yep. Oh, and that is a super, super creepy Dolly artwork before Dolly was terrible.
Yeah.
Or before Dolly got good.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very disturbing bunch of kids.
Oh, gosh. Weird. Oh, they do look weird. Well, hey, I think that's a show. Unless there was, we'll have to get to the rest of our feedback in our next show.
Yep. We need to schedule another.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's go. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. See you later.
Yeah.
Bye.
And I'm the host of the other Zoom, so I gotta get. Like, I forgot
gotta
that
get
it,
there.
Like,
so yeah. All right. So how do you want to do scheduling the text?
Yeah, let's,
or
no, let's schedule right now. Like,
okay.
Yeah, I think I can. Could you do? What does June 11th look like to you? Tuesday.
Ooh, wide open. That's King Kamehameha Day.
Oh, well, that's phenomenal. The congratulations, I think. I could do any time before noon or any time after one.
Oh, let's do one.
Yep, perfect. Done. Food Safety Talk, 1 o'clock on June 11th.
Sure, 1 to 3 p.m., let's say, and then we will work it out from there. Good.
All right, cool. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye.